Friends, I am indeed glad to be here this afternoon at this Bharatiya Sanskrit Samsat, where I have just seen great many stalwarts have come, presented their thought, their music, their art. So it's a great privilege for me to follow the lines of the great masters of Indian culture. Well, I'm here today to try and present something of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. I'm sure some of you have already been introduced to this yoga. You have heard from other exponents of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. But I am quite a novice on this path, because to speak about Sri Aurobindo is really very difficult, because he was a personality who was not to be understood by the human mind. You see, if you look at his life, you see basically one who is impersonal and yet involved deeply in the affairs of the country and the world, one who was completely detached with his family, and yet who loved dearly his wife, one who wrote profusely and yet never thought of what he was writing, one who really left behind him great opportunities to win fame and money and name and prosperity, and yet who sacrificed everything for the service of the motherland. One who was to begin with an agnostic, and yet he realized the divine and lived in the Brahmic consciousness for years together. So how can we human minds try to understand this enigmatic personality? Therefore, many people do not approach him. They say he is too complex and complicated. So Sri Aurobindo has remained quite an incognito in our own country. A country for which he lay down the best years of his life. A country that does not even acknowledge his great contribution to its own freedom movement. History books do not record, because history books have been written by prejudiced minds. And yet you go back to those days when Sri Aurobindo was here in Bengal, and you see the daily reports in the daily newspapers, reports of the work that he has done, the speeches that he has given. And also if you have ever some time, read his Vande Mataram writings. And you see and you'll find to your surprise that here was a man who had laid the foundations of the freedom movement of the country. All the movements of non-cooperation which later were attached to Gandhiji, but long before him, were laid down by Sri Aurobindo himself. And then long before Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose took up the movement of a national insurrection, it was Sri Aurobindo who had laid that principle as one of the means of getting freedom of the country. And yet, people hardly know what Sri Aurobindo has contributed. He left this place, Bengal, Calcutta, in 1910, not because he was frightened of the British, not even because he was tired of the politics, but because he had an adesh, an inner voice telling him, go to Chandanagar. And he was so very surrendered to this divine voice, he says within 10 minutes, he left his Calcutta office and was there on the Ghat and on the Ganges. And he traveled overnight to Chandanagar, and from there he was asked to go to Pondicherry by the same voice. So Sri Aurobindo has always remained in the back. He has never wanted, as he said, any propaganda or any name or fame for himself. So that's why I start saying that here is the most mysterious personality that we have seen in our recent history. And yet I would dare say that this mysterious personality would be the one of whom mankind will speak in the next few generations. He is already quite a big name in the West. People are avid to know about his integral yoga, to know about his integral philosophy, and especially to read his great mantric epic poem, Savitri. In the West, people have taken to this book as they had long back taken to the Bible. They read it every day, meditate upon those verses, because they feel a great peace, a great solace. Like we in India often take to reading the Bhagavad Gita, the West has taken to Sri Aurobindo's Savitri. The message is still to unravel itself, but already he has become a slow fire in the human consciousness, and people are taking to him. So it's because of that I said that he may be less known today, but he will be most known tomorrow. And I can tell you all this because for the past 10 years, I have been going to the West, to Europe, to America, to Russia, and in all these countries, even in the so-called communist Russia, people are so very eager to know what is this integral yoga after all. We have heard of many yogas, and friends, you know, in the West there are dozens of new yogas of which we in India haven't even heard of. Every year almost there is a new yoga that is born in the West. So they are eager to know what is this comprehensive yoga, which is a synthesis of all yogas and yet surpasses all the yogas, which is so very comprehensive that Sri Aurobindo called it all life is yoga. That is the basic sentence, basic concept that with which Sri Aurobindo starts his yoga. It is said, and rightly so, that where and when other yogas end, Sri Aurobindo's yoga begins. That is what is said to be the truth of Sri Aurobindo's integral yoga, or the yoga of the supramental descent and transformation. Sri Aurobindo's yoga is known by many names. Some call it the Purna Yoga. Some call it the Supramental Yoga. Some call it the Integral Yoga. Doesn't matter what we call, but the basic ideas are what I'm going to describe this morning and this afternoon. But as I promised to you earlier, I'll try to show one by one how Sri Aurobindo has synthesized all the great yoga systems that have come to India in its long history. You see, Sri Aurobindo himself began yoga in 1904, when he was in the thick of politics. Sri Aurobindo primarily called himself a politician and a poet. His first phase of his life was of the politician. Right when he returned to India, till he left for Pondicherry, he was basically a politician. And then from 1910 to 1950, he was basically a poet. People think him to be a philosopher, but no. He was not a philosopher as we understand philosophy to be. So as a politician, of course, that is a pattern of his life, which we would not like to enter right now. But let us see about what he has done about yoga. You see, in 1904, when he was in the thick of politics in Baroda, and later in 1906, when he came down to Calcutta and became the principal of Jadavpur University, of course it was a different name in those times, he on the outer level was writing Bande Mataram, that means dozens of writings every day, dozens of pages. He was guiding many and insurgent movements. You know, in Bengal we had these great revolutionaries. He was guiding them, inspiring them. And what all he wrote in the Bande Mataram was like a fire set in India. All the young people, may it be south or north or east or west, all those who read the Bande Mataram, they were caught by the fire of nationalism and patriotism. So imagine a man who is so thickly involved, to the extent he wrote in one of his letters to his wife, "I'm sorry, I just can't meet you for the next so many days and years and months because I'm so thickly involved in the works of the Congress, in the works of the Bande Mataram, in the works of the revolutionary movements, it is not possible for me to come home." And yet, this was the same man who was practicing or had started practice in the beginning at Baroda, hours on end of pranayam. If I'm right in my memory, of almost about 8 hours a day he would do pranayam. Not that he was bunking his work, but along with the work that he was doing for the Maharaja of Gaikwad at Baroda, which as you can see was perhaps a very taxing work. At the same time he was the principal of the MS University of Baroda. And with all this he did long hours of pranayam to begin with. And what he found there was great results of his mind opening up to new faculties. So he started writing poetry with great inspiration. Prior to pranayam, he wrote a couple of poems, but with the strength of pranayam, with the energy of pranayam, with the vision of pranayam that got opened within him, he started writing poetry profusely. And then his literary critical faculty became sharp. He was not trained in criticizing, analyzing any poetry. He was never an artist per se, and yet he could be the best of the art critics. So he saw that all these faculties were opening up, and he did practice that, but then there was a kind of a limit. Pranayama gave him the faculties of the mind, but it did not open his soul, the Atman. So he said, that's no use. He took up yoga, not because he wanted to gain power, because he says he wanted to gain that energy with which he could help the country gain independence. So what all he did was for the sake of the country, never for his own name. Imagine when he was working with the Maharaja and as the principal of the MS University, or at that time it was the college, he used to get a very high salary. And yet he says, all my talents, all the money, all that is gained, I have gained, does not belong to me, it belongs to God. So he would keep his money on a tray on his table, and anyone, his sister or his servant or his friends, could take that money away. Because he says, what all I need, God will give me. And if I use more than my need, he said, then I am a thief. So that was his principle of money and detachment. So he never bothered for his power or money. And then he would say that many consider our country to be a country with borders of Himalayas and with Ganges rivers and valleys and plains. But for me the country is my motherland. And he says, can any son see his mother being strangled and yet keep quiet? So how can I keep quiet when my Bharat Mata is being strangled by a foreign country? So he wrote to his wife, this is one of my madnesses and I have to liberate my suffering country or motherland. And then he writes to her saying, if God exists, I must see him face to face. Because by then he had read all the Vedas and the Upanishads after returning to Baroda from England. He read the Gita, he had started translating in fact the Vedas. And then he said, I know there is God, but just knowing is not sufficient. I have to see him face to face. So this was the kind of a man who had the strong beliefs, who was detached with money, who didn't want name and fame, who considered like the Arjuna's advice that nothing belongs to you, everything is the divine's. And he said, that's what I believe. So I'm trying to show you these parallels. One side, he was practicing yoga inside, and on the outer level, he was the most busy man, busiest in any circumstances. But this is precisely what I would like you to understand, that yoga and spirituality are not devoid and divorced from life. We think spirituality means this: go to temples, go to pujas, go to Himalayas, go to meditation, go to these centers and skip your work, and because karma yoga is something wrong because it takes you into greater attachment. But here was a karma yogin and a jnana yogi who are going parallelly together. Of course his own bhakti comes little later, but here was a kind of a parallel role, karma at its best and jnana at its highest. Well, he started, as I said, His yoga 1904. But then soon he left pranayama, and then he went deeper into his own realizations. And while he was in Baroda, he had many spiritual experiences. Once he was on the banks of the river Narmada, and he sees a small Kali temple. I mean, you know, on the banks of Narmada, I have also gone and seen the great temple. But it was not a really beautiful Kali Mandir that you would see in Calcutta. Of course, in Calcutta there are different kinds of Kali Mandirs. But that was a very rustic one, rudimentary sculpture. And yet when he went there, he saw actually the goddess Kali coming out of the statue and blessing him. In fact, later on he wrote a beautiful poem called The Stone Goddess. And some years back, I went to the Narmada River, and those Purohits there put that poem of Sri Aurobindo in the temple. Well, he had once again been with the Maharaja to Kashmir. And there is some temple called the Shankaracharya Temple there. Or it has also got another name called the Takht-e-Suleiman. And there, out of nowhere, not that he was meditating upon and sitting there for 8 hours or 20 hours. No. In the midst of his active life, suddenly he has the experience of the Nirguna Brahman. The experience that the great Shankaracharya has had, and all of us in India, we know what the experience was, that Brahman is reality, Jagat is a mithya. And that experience he had in Kashmir. Well, like that, here was a man, inwardly he was growing fast spiritually, and almost all the peak experiences that our ancients have, Buddha's Nirvana, Shankaracharya's Brahman, and then this question of the Atman within, he had the experiences, all this, while he was in Baroda. So when he comes to Bengal in 1906, and becomes the principal of the National College here, he was already an adept yogi, somebody who had really realized the divine within. And it is that knowledge which poured out into his Vande Mataram. And out of that knowledge, when he goes back, goes to Pondicherry, he wrote a great journal called the Arya. And in that journal, Arya, which he started writing in 1914, and he wrote till 1921, just 7 years. And remember, in the 7 years, he wrote most of his books. I mean, all the great books that he wrote there, 30 volumes are there now, but out of which there are a few which he wrote at that time, about 6 to 7 books, parallelly. If anyone has seen here, maybe the Dada has seen at the Nainital Ashram, a great massive books of about 1200 pages called The Life Divine. Then there's Ideal of Human Unity, The Human Cycle, The Foundations of Indian Culture, then The Future Poetry, The Vedas, The Upanishads, Essays on the Gita. Imagine such massive books he wrote simultaneously. How could he do that? Because of his own experience. So when somebody said, you are a philosopher, you have written so much philosophy, he says, no. Because a philosopher thinks out of his mind. We don't call Shankaracharya and Ramanujacharya as philosophers, we have called them acharyas. That means somebody who has based himself on experience. Whereas philosophers is more a term applied to the Westerners, because theirs is more mind-based. In India, our great philosophies have come from acharyas who realize the divine within. So that was the massive work that Sri Aurobindo did. And one of those books at that time was called The Synthesis of Yoga. And it is in this Synthesis of Yoga that he brings in a wonderful synthesis of all the yoga that we have at present. Not at present, but at present there are hundreds of yogas, but the major yoga systems in the country. And that's what, in brief, I would like to tell you, because one can go at a great length, but as I look at my watch, I don't have much of a time, so I'll try to see as much as possible within the prescribed time. You see, first of all, we have to understand the synthesis of the three great schools in the country, schools of Vedanta. Now, what are they? I'm sure some of you may know here. We have from the ancient times Shankaracharya, that school of philosophy which came to be known as Kevala Advaita. Kevala Advaita, that means Brahman alone is truth. Kevala, he alone. Then we have the Ramanuja school called the Vishishta Advaita, that's the non-dualist. And then we have the Dvaita by Madhva. Well, I'm starting to tell you this because this is the foundation of Indian life principle. I mean, you may belong to any sect, you may belong to any school, but basically you would be slaughtered, you would be put into the slots of either Shankara or Ramanuja, who believes both the world and Brahman are equally real. Shankara said only Brahman is real, the world is a mitta. Ramanuja says no, both are real. Then Madhva says that both are real, but one is dependent on the other. That means the world and the soul, they are not independent, they are dependent on Brahman. So there's a kind of a lesser importance given to this. However, you see, this is the eternal quarrel that we have been having for the past 1000 years. Shankara came to negate the Buddha, because Buddha's principles, as some of you may know who have studied the Indian philosophy, he was a great revolutionary himself. But one who did not believe in the great past of the Vedas and the Upanishads, he said, no, I do not take them to be my authorities. So you can imagine what a great mind he was. At a time when India was swayed by only one philosophy, the Vedanta, and yet here comes Buddha, he says, no, I do not believe in that. I do not take them to be authorities. I will have to find my own salvation. I will have to find my own path. And therefore he says, let us be self-dependent and not dependent on some authority or on some book or some acharya. You see, there was already a trend of modernism in Buddha, because today you believe, specially influenced by the Western mind, we say we have to make our own future. The future is in our own hands. And that's what the Buddha said, find your salvation by yourself. So he negated all those authorities. And yet, that negation went so far that he was ultimately, Buddhism itself was negated from our own India. Because you see, in India, we basically need the concept of God. We may follow it or not, but at least we have a kind of a psychological support. Yes, God exists in some form or the other. But when the Buddha says there's neither God nor soul nor Atman, nothing, somehow these teachings, they could not last in our country. That is why they were driven out to Sri Lanka and to, you know, to Indonesia and to Thailand and to China and to Japan. So Buddha remained here, but Buddhism went out. Because India as a culture is based on the realization and acceptance of God. We have lot of atheists, We may have a lot of non-believers, but in majority, as an ethos, we are God-believers. But that is the Buddha who ruled the country for quite a few centuries. You know all these Ellora and Ajanta caves and the paintings. And so it happened that a lot of youngsters took to Buddhism, and it was Shankaracharya who argued against the Buddha and Buddhism and established once again the Vedanta and the Vedas. That is the great role of Shankaracharya, that he brought back Hinduism. Had not Shankara come on the scene, maybe we would have been a Buddhist country today. But Shankaracharya brought back Hinduism a la Vedanta. But Shankara had his own problem of denying the reality of the world. So after a couple of centuries comes Ramanuja, who establishes this Vaishnavism, where he says, no, the world is true, the divine Brahman is true, and both are equally true. However, they were excluding, there was a quarrel, or constantly there would be, you know, negative debates between the schools. But here comes Sri Aurobindo, who synthesized all of them, and then he would say, well, let's not fight. All the three views are correct in their own way. Because he would say that whenever we have nirguna and saguna, that's what we understand the philosophical. Nirguna is without qualities, saguna is with qualities. So Sri Aurobindo said they are two sides of the same coin. They are not mutually exclusive. One side is nirguna, and the other side is saguna. So it's a single coin. So he says, I don't find any kind of a debate and a dissociation between Ramanuja and Shankara. They are equally true, the two sides of the same coin. So basically, he brought out this kind of a synthesis between the idea of the Vedic schools, Vedanta schools, and then there is another great synthesis, and we have a great school called the Tantra. You see, Tantra, especially in Bengal, all of you staying here would know, was very popular. And as a school, Tantrism was again something completely different from Vedanta. You see, Vedanta, all the schools of Shankaracharya, Ramanuja, etc., they talked only about Brahman, about the Purusha. Nobody talked about the Prakriti. In fact, the Prakriti of the world was something non-existent, it was a mitha. But Tantrism went to the other side. He said, no, I'm sorry. The world is real, and it is a Shakti which is the transformative force. So for you and me, what is more important is the Shakti, the force, the energy. And today our science establishes that all that is there is the energy. So energy is primary and Purusha is beyond. So Tantra established the philosophy of the Shakti and of the power. So Sri Aurobindo, he brought a synthesis again between Vedanta and Shakti and Tantra. He says, again, why should there be a quarrel between Purusha and Prakriti, Vedanta and Tantra? The way he synthesized these two was that this Shakti is the energy, is the power of Brahman. Please remember, the simple word of makes the entire difference. That means, like we have, you know, the question of fire. You take fire, there are two things in fire. One is its light, and the other is its burning capacity. So he says, you cannot segregate these two. They are one and the same, but there are two aspects to it. It gives light and it burns. So what burns is the Shakti, is the energy. And what gives light is the Purusha. So Sri Aurobindo once again brought them together and he said, we can have a synthesis and we don't have to have any quarrels between the two. And that was the regarding the Vedanta and Tantra. And I'm giving you all this, but we will see in Sri Aurobindo itself what happens later on. Now coming to the yoga schools. In the schools of yoga, you may have heard from other scholars that in India we have had basically five systems of yoga. What we have, the Hatha Yoga, we have the Raja Yoga, we have Jnana Yoga, we have Karma Yoga, and the Bhakti Yoga. So let there be any system that the world is bringing out today, they are bound to fall into one of these five categories. You cannot have anything beyond them. And yet there could be the sixth one, that is the integral yoga. I'll tell you about that. So these five yogas were there parampara, perennially. But what happened was that this Hatha Yoga is basically concerned with the body, what we call the Annamaya Kosha. So the entire West today, at least 90% of the Westerners think yoga means Hatha Yoga, doing asanas, doing postures, added with a bit of pranayama, a bit of meditation. So when I went out to the West, the moment you utter the word yoga, they say, yes, we know yoga. What is it? It's 42 poses of asanas. But I'm afraid they have not understood the meaning of yoga. Yoga itself, the word means to unite. So yoga is not an asana, it is a practice of union. And union with the divine. Union of the lower nature with the higher nature. It is not to be taken in any other sense of union. So this was misunderstood. And then recently in this May in Italy, there was a huge conference of over 200 yogacharyas who had come to a place, a seminar in Italy. And there they invited me to speak on Sri Aurobindo's yoga. So for the first time they understood the different shades of yoga. However, because Hatha Yoga is basically physical, so it suited very well the Western mind. Because they are in need of the development of the physical, the body. They don't want to have the Atman realization. So obviously they lapped up all our yoga masters who went there. They have learned our techniques, and may I tell you friends, they do better yoga than most of us. It's incredible. But because their body is wonderful, supple, you know, they practice a lot. And I've seen these yoga masters excellent in their yoga postures. That's what is wonderful about the Westerners. Whatever they take up, they're very, very honest and sincere and perseverant. So that is the Hatha Yoga, which sort of, you know, was emphasizing upon the development of the body, which brought in a great amount of health, longevity, suppleness, etc. And also it helped opening the different chakras. That was Hatha Yoga. But then Sri Aurobindo does not take to Hatha Yoga. Because you see, Sri Aurobindo tried a synthesis and he says it's very difficult exactly to put them all together. You see, you cannot put Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga and Bhakti Yoga in one basket. Because each of these yogas have got centuries of background and they have got their own specialization. So you cannot just mingle them and say, hey, all of you come under the same shade, under the same shelter. So Sri Aurobindo says, I would like to make a synthesis taking up the central principle, not the practices. Please remember, this is the difference. The central principle of all these yogas, he says, I can combine, but not the individual practices. Now, to give you an example, in Hatha Yoga, we have got these asanas. These are the practices. But what's the principle? To unite with the divine in the body. That's why it's called the Hatha Yoga. That means you unite with the divine through the body consciousness, through Annamaya Kosha. So Sri Aurobindo take that principle of union with the divine in the physical, not the asanas and the pranayama. He says, if you want to do well, I have nothing against. But they are not the essential ingredients of integral yoga. So he says, body we must develop. Because as all of you know, and I'll tell you a little more about integral yoga at the end of this synthesis. In Sri Aurobindo, the body and its transformation have a great role. So, Hatha Yoga, he takes it up, but only the principle of changing the physical, making it healthy, etc. Now, coming to Raja Yoga. In Raja Yoga, we have the emphasis on the Manomaya Purusha or Manomaya Kosha, and this depends on the mind, that purification of the mind. And you see this wonderful system in India, some concentrated on the mind, on the body, and Raja Yoga concentrates on